We're very pleased to have Ron Solomon again. Ron is treasurer of the Secular Coalition for America, as well as treasurer of one of the member organizations, the American Ethical Union. Another of the member organizations is the American Humanist Association, and there are eight other member organizations. I guess we're going to hear today about the hot issues that the Secular Coalition for America is dealing with in Washington, D.C. at present. For many years, the religious right has had powerful organizations, well-funded organizations, whose voice has been well heard in Washington. And it's just in recent years that we've had this alternative voice available. So we're very pleased to have Ron talk to us today.
Well, hello, everybody. And thank you for sitting in here on this beautiful day. Although I know the nature walk starts in an hour. Looks like it's going to be a good afternoon for that, too.
It's a lot warmer.
Just a quick little bit of background about the Secular Coalition for America. You, of course, are aware that there are many people and groups that are very, very interested in preserving the secular character of our government and the separation of church and state. That, you know, has been enshrined in our Constitution. And many of those people are actually from some of the more traditional mainstream religions. But it was clear to people from the group that we can characterize with lots of names, like humanist, atheist, ethical culture, and so forth, free thinkers, rationalists, that there was no unified voice representing that constituency. And so a few years ago, several organizations got together and talked about the idea of trying to create an organization that would specifically focus on lobbying in Washington to represent the voice of non-theists and atheists and free thinkers. And the Secular Coalition was born. I think it had five groups originally, and now, as Bob said, it's expanded up to 10, and continually talking to one or two groups at a time about joining, and so it may continue to expand. It has really grown by leaps and bounds. Their initial idea in, I think, 2005 was that they would be able to hire a part-time lobbyist, but they quickly, in about a year and a half, got to a full-time lobbyist, and now they actually have two or three full-time people, one of whom does lobbying exclusively and the others who do it part of the time. So they've really obviously touched a chord with people in this country who believe that this is very important and to have this representational voice. So they've been very active there, and they've done any number of things over these last few years. And I just thought I'd touch briefly on some of the most recent things that they've been involved in, and then we can talk in more detail, perhaps, if you want to, about several of those. But just to give you an idea of what they've done, in the last 3 months, I just was looking at a report they did from between June and September. They had 51 direct lobbying contacts with 35 different U.S. senators. They talked about particularly the school voucher program in the District of Columbia, which has been used to fund a lot of religious schools with government money. Religion-based medical neglect, military proselytizing, and discrimination. And they've written letters, and they've talked about abstinence-only sex education funding, repealing the global gag rule.
What's that?
On that you can't talk about contraception or abortion as a part of family planning. You can only talk about abstinence.
That's in order to get federal money.
Right. I just didn't know what it was.
They've tried to raise some issues around the nomination of John McHugh for Secretary of the Army. They've worked for repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act and support for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. They've also worked with some other groups that represent some religious organizations, like the Coalition Against Religious Discrimination, to Attorney General Eric Holder. They wrote a letter that is questioning an opinion that was issued by the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department under former President Bush, that they say erroneously exempted religious organizations receiving federal dollars from abiding by federal non-discrimination provisions. So these are the kinds of things they've really been highly involved in. And it's hard to know really how much to really talk about any of these in detail. I think the important things to know really are that anybody who's interested in what they're doing, you can sign up for action alerts that they send out by email through their website. Their website is www.secular.org, and there's a thing right on there to sign up for action alerts. And they do about 7 or 8 a year, and basically they send you a notice that something hot is happening right at that moment, and that urge you to contact either your senator or your representative, whichever is appropriate. And I'll give you a brief list of what they've done in 2009 recently in their action alerts. The most recent one was to stop promoting religion at the Capitol Visitor Center. I mean, it's just, you know, when you see these things, you think about them and you like, where do these things even come from? You know, how do they come up?
Come up with it, right.
And that, you know, and it, at one level you think, this is such like a minor thing. You know, we've got so many major problems going on, you know, with health care reform and wars and the economy and everything.
It's a slippery slope. Get a 1 foot in the door and they can't get rid of them.
Anyway, they had a vote in the House of Representatives, and they actually voted 410-8 to continue this promotion of by engraving the words "In God We Trust."
In the Visitor Center, this was?
Yeah. So there were only 8 representatives in the entire U.S. House of Representatives who were willing to stand up and vote against it.
Can you name them?
I can name them. I have it right here. And none of them, sadly, is from Wisconsin.
Feingold is on our side. Oh, my God.
This is the House. He's in the Senate.
Oh, the House.
But Tammy Baldwin isn't on this list. John Conyers from Michigan. That's the closest person to us, geographically at least. Donna Edwards from Maryland, my former state, although not my former representative. Mazie Hirono from Hawaii. Huh. Mike Honda from California. Jim McDermott from Washington. Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas. Bobby Scott from Virginia. And Pete Stark from California.
Is that Pete Stark, the one who admitted he's an atheist?
Right.
Unitarian.
And a Unitarian. Oh, my, he's everything.
Do they feel it's an election breaker? I'm assuming that's why. I mean, regardless of their own personal feelings, that if they don't support it, they're going to be voted out of office. Do they feel that the religious right is so strong, or religious people in general are strong, that they would...
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I'm sure different representatives would answer it differently, and perhaps they wouldn't answer it honestly. But, for example, I have not done this, and maybe I should have, but, you know, I think, you know, I'm fairly new to Wisconsin, so I don't know my people really very well yet, but, you know, I kind of have this sense that Tammy Baldwin is like a pretty good congressperson, but I haven't called to find out, like, you know, why didn't you stand up and vote against
this? I'd like to know.
Well, she has some other personal baggage that she can't shake.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Like I say, I don't know enough about her, but
But maybe we, if we had made a more vocal issue out of it, she would have voted the other way.
Right.
Right. Well, that's part of the thing. And maybe, you know, if more of us were signed up for these action alerts and actually, you know, when this vote was coming up, you know, if maybe she had heard from 100 people in her district, maybe that would have helped. I mean, we don't know. Yeah.
Well, now, when these lobbyists only talk to 35 senators, that isn't the majority.
Well, that was in 3 months. Remember, I'm only talking about in the last 3 months.
Yeah,
okay.
Galen? Last night, I think it was, on LRR, they had a couple of experts talking about the politics in Washington, and they said that the next year's election, where a lot of these Congress people are going to be up for re-election, they're really worried about losing. They won the last election on the coattails of Obama.
Right.
Now they don't have his coattails. And they're being super cautious about saying anything that might lose them in just a few votes even.
Well, has that been in since the early in the country, that In God We Trust? That was recent too? I mean, it's not like the national anthem where they just added it.
I think In God We Trust has been on our money for a long time, but since the 19th century.
Just a calculation. Now, here's a fight you're not going to win, and you're going to have to deal with a lot of these people on a lot of issues you're really interested in. So why stand up and alienate these people for no reason at all?
And that's what I said. Because it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's, I guess, the fundamental question that we face with everything. It's like, you know, there are so many battles that can be fought and that need to be fought. And it's almost impossible to figure out each time, you know, is this battle worth fighting? And like we, you know, this guy, Michael Newdow, who's challenged In God We Trust and the Pledge of Allegiance and the fact that kids have to say it in school.
Oh, under God.
One Nation Under God.
It was added in the 50s.
Some of us learned it without that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Most of us
preferred it without all of us.
Probably all of us here.
Yeah. I don't know what it's in there for.
Right.
Screws it up.
He actually came to the Secular Coalition and asked them if they would basically sign on to his lawsuit. And they talked about it and decided that this was not a battle for them to officially get into, but encouraged member organizations to consider supporting him, and I think some of them did.
What process do they use to pick their battles? I mean,
what
are they, do you know what factors? Well, you're on the board, so you probably know.
It's actually funny. I'm not on the board.
Oh, you're not.
They have a very strange situation. I didn't even know that when they asked me to be their treasurer, that their officers are not on the board. Each member organization is encouraged to send two representatives to each board meeting, but they have one vote. Each organization has one vote at the board meeting. And the officers are not on the board. The president, however, presides over the board and can cast tie-breaking or tie-creating votes.
So do you attend and listen
to
the
debates? So we attend
and
we report and, they have a couple of vice presidents and a secretary and a treasurer and a president.
I have a question on that. We never hear about the Freedom from Religion Foundation in any of these coalitions. And is it because
they are a member of it?
They are a member. I didn't list them because I thought, do they go their own way or
they were of the first five. Weren't they?
Yeah, they're one of the originals. And they've grown by leaps and bounds over the last few years. And I've heard Dan Barker say that he thinks that at least part of that is this cooperation that the groups have done It's been interesting because you probably all know that you know, some people that are members of different organizations are very passionate about the specifics of their organization and think that, you know, everybody else ought to be aligned with them 100%.
I've noticed that.
and so sometimes they're not willing to cooperate with other groups. And this secular coalition has really, I think, been a model for bringing disparate groups together that are really, fundamentally, we're all the same, but in particulars, we're a little different. And I've met atheists who will tell me, you know, that they just, you know, they can't comprehend anybody who would call themselves a humanist, or especially not a religious humanist. And I've met humanists and religious humanists who say the same thing about atheists, and on and on, you know. And I think, you know, that we agree on so many things, pretty much, but it's really good, I think, that this coalition has been formed and has been as successful as it has been.
Speaking of humanists, the Council for Secular Humanism is not a member of this.
No, they're not, but that doesn't mean that they
tend to
be
non-joiners, apparently.
So what do they... what process or what criteria do they use to decide which issues they're going to emphasize?
Well, I think fundamentally they just go with, you know, what their particular mission statement is, which is really focused on separation between government and religion, and to represent the non-theistic community. And that's the word they've tried to settle on as sort of the umbrella term for all of us. And there are people who have trouble with that word. But they've said, but one of the things that they've said in defense of having kind of picked that word is there's no group that uses that word. In other words,
right, there's
American atheists. So if you say we're the atheists, suddenly everybody's going to think you're the American atheists, or you're the Atheist Alliance International, which is another big atheist group in the United States. And, well, they also have chapters around the world in other countries. But, you know, so if you pick the word atheist, they think, okay, you're the atheist. Or
well,
if you pick the word humanist, you're either the secular humanist, or you're the religious humanist, or the American Humanist Association, or something of that sort, right? Or ethical culture, you're the ethical culturist, right? So they pick non-theists because there's no organization that says, you know, we're the non-theist association of the United States or whatever. So, so that was one good reason for picking that term, is they weren't favoring any one group at the exclusion of other groups. So, but they still have some people who are like, what does that mean exactly? And, you know, I've heard my son and some of his friends who are in this Madison Ethical Discussion Group, they're like, I don't like that term. What does it mean? I don't even know what it means. I was like, okay, well, you know, we could get into those discussions. But is it really worth it?
Has any group ever applied and been turned down by this coalition?
I do not know that for a fact. I do know that what they have done in the last few years as they have actually cultivated some groups to join. And they have done it in a very, very carefully procedural way to try and avoid a group actually applying and being discussed at a board meeting and turned down. So they've tried to like lay the groundwork in advance through discussions and then actually encourage them to submit an application. And one of the reasons for that is because there have been among some of these groups some strong disagreements that, in my opinion, have been mostly caused by personalities. but not entirely, but mostly by personalities. And one perfect example is these two atheist groups, which I'm picking out, not because I have anything against them, I like them all, but because this was a real thing, that one of the atheist groups was part of the original coalition, and there was discussion about the other atheist group joining. And some of the previous leadership of the other atheist group had had a history of really not cooperating with any other groups. And so people, like, you know, didn't even want to get involved with them because they weren't cooperative. But their leadership changed, and so, you know, over like a year period, they went through this process of cultivating some relationships and then inviting them to join. So there are other groups out there that this, you know, historically may have been part of the reason why they aren't there yet, but maybe they will be in the future. I was, you know, I'd started mentioning the most recent action alert that had come out, this one about the In God We Trust at the Capitol Visitor Center. But the one before that is even a little more insidious if you think about it. There's a resolution in Congress sponsored by somebody from Virginia, Randy Forbes, who is also happens to be the founder and chairman of the Congressional Prayer Caucus. And he introduced a resolution that would affirm the rich spirit, I'm quoting, that would affirm the rich spiritual and religious history of our nation's founding and subsequent history, and express support for designation of the first week in May as America's Spiritual Heritage Week for the appreciation of and education on America's history of religious faith. That's the whole quote. So when he first introduced it, there were 27 co-sponsors in the House, and this was one of the action alerts that in early May to contact your representative and encourage them, A, to not co-sponsor, and B, to oppose this resolution if they happen to be on the committee or if it ever comes to the House floor. There are now, as of October, 5 months later, there are now 75 co-sponsors.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Of it.
It's still the same, and they didn't change it to whatever your spiritual background is? It's got to be religious?
One thing we can be happy about is none of those co-sponsors is from Wisconsin.
Oh, there we go. We knew there was something good about it.
Sensenbrenner is not signed on?
No. Nobody from Wisconsin.
Maybe he's afraid to sign.
This resolution would put Congress on record as, quote, recognizing the religious foundations of faith on which America was built are critical underpinnings of our nation's most valuable institutions and form the inseparable foundation for America's representative processes, legal systems, and societal structures. Now,
in other words,
I don't
know
about
know
you,
his history.
But you know, if you don't consider yourself a traditional believer in God, does this offend you? Does this like?
It offends me even if I didn't.
Well, he doesn't know his history.
Of course not.
Founding fathers even delivered
he
wanted separation.
It's whittling away at the wall between church and state.
Right.
Is
exactly.
It still active now? Or they still, it never was voted on, huh?
No, this is still in a committee. And there is at least some indication that it may never even have hearings in the committee.
Oh, good.
It's, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, any of you who've paid any attention at all to the legislative process know how mysterious and arcane it is and how full of pitfalls it can be.
So this is not going to go away. And is it Barton? I forget the name. That is one of the religious right authors and organizers. Is, you know, he specializes in digging up anything he can from bits and pieces of history to support his notion that we are strictly a
Christian nation.
I mean, right. And this is code for Christianity. I mean, they're not going to teach Native American religions. They're not, you know, they're not in the least bit interested in teaching any sort of philosophy or ethical structure. This is, I'm sure, Christian based. And it would be interesting to know the religious backgrounds of the people that are sponsoring it, and I can't imagine they're not all not only Christian but religious right. My personal connection with the founding of this country would be my a relative who was a magistrate, put in prison the first witch in coastal town in Connecticut. And, I don't really want to go back to that.
Right.
Well, it's interesting, though, because they really, there's an aspect of this that I'm interested in, that if they could get to the spiritual basis, period, like you said, bring up the, you know, American Indian stuff and, or Natives, and also the role of non-believers. And, you know, I think it could actually have be a kind of an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. But obviously that isn't what he has
That's
in mind at all.
And I think we'd have to fight pretty hard to...
Well, and that's what makes it so subversive.
Exactly. Exactly. It's sort of like putting under God in the... I mean, like, well, what about those of us who don't feel like we're under God? Therefore, we... I mean, I won't even stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance anymore because it's so offensive to me. It's just offensive. It's not representing me.
What actual thing would happen if they pass this resolution? Would the average person ever know or care what they did?
It might give them an argument to teach it in the schools.
It might, but I was just wondering if what people think the effect would be. They pass a lot of laws that nobody ever hears of and name office buildings after obscure politicians that nobody heard of.
Like Ronald Reagan before he died.
With the current makeup of the, some of the increasingly widespread religious right groups that are promoting this sort of thing, this isn't going to go away. I think if this were passed, I think that there would be
more.
Schools throughout the country would be lobbied for
to celebrate it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for this, and it would be Christian-based.
And it would be kind of, then you start to twist history to, you know, how they say the winners write the history books. You know, you begin to, it's already pretty twisted, but you'd be twisting it more, you know.
Is the current world financial crisis, economic meltdown, or whatever you call it, have anything to do with this, that huge increase in anxiety on the part of the general public, and they're turning to authoritarian sources for support, from emotional and moral support more and more?
Well, that's an interesting question, I think.
Well, we trusted in God, and that didn't work.
Maybe they'll trust in their priests.
I'm not really a historian, but I know that we certainly have some examples from history of times when economic times get tough. It seems like more and more people start looking for scapegoats, and whether that's religious based or ethnic based or whatever, we've seen lots and lots of examples of that, and certainly those who want to capitalize on those things and take advantage of them certainly find opportunities to do so in those kinds of situations.
Well, the present efforts to do that go back to the Nixon administration and prior. I mean, the notion of merging religion, politics, and wealth is, what's happening now had its foundation there, and I think that the actually script for it was probably written in that period of time, and it's taken many, many forms, but it's been developing over time. And this is a prime time with mm-hmm. people under stress to focus on this sort of thing. I think Elon's right, but it's the actual underpinnings of it are they're political and they're financial and they're religious and they're all put together.
Political, to follow up on an earlier comment about the upcoming congressional elections in the last year, I'll bet you find that most of these sponsors are already campaigning for next year, so they can tell their constituents that they're for this particular bill. So they're angling for the votes of that. What the political pundits are saying is that the electoral turnouts are going to be a lot lower than the next congressional. It'll be so that the
motivated will rule the world.
Are trying, trying to motivate their their base. Their,
right. Well, typically they are.
They know that they're going to lose a lot of their base, maybe 20%. I think the figures were just because people aren't going to be very motivated to come out and vote.
Not
going to
be as
That's
excited.
Both parties.
Yeah. Well, typically in the non-presidential years, right. the election turnouts are much smaller. I mean, it's, you know, one of the sad commentaries on the way in which I think far too many Americans look at
they're complacent
at this country and, you know, what it is and what it can be. You know, they just are way too lackadaisical about their responsibilities as citizens. And that, but that's just another whole.
Were there other, issues that generated alerts this year?
Yeah, they encourage people to actually contact the president and thank him for promoting our secular identity back in April.
He said the word.
If you remember the talk he gave in Turkey, where he repudiated the religious rights fallacy that the United States is a Christian nation.
How do you say non-believers?
You can't really imagine our previous president ever having said anything like that, right?
Maybe he should have won the Nobel Prize just for that.
Well, I think those are the kinds of things that he did win the Nobel Prize for. You can argue whether it was justifiable or not, but I think those are the kinds of things they were thinking about, that he's promoting this more, you know, cooperation and dialogue among people who are focusing on their ideals and values and not on their particular interpretations of ultimate reality.
The deadline for nominations was way back in January.
Right, but the reason that the committee was looking at may have happened after that.
The one before that was a good one because we actually won it. It was during the omnibus spending bill for 2009. An amendment was submitted by John Ensign from Nevada, Republican, in the Senate, that would have extended funding for a voucher program in the D.C. schools, in D.C., that would pay parents to send their children to private religious schools. And the Senate voted down that amendment, and both of our senators voted the right way on that one. Both Feingold and Cole. So that was good.
Was it even close?
You know, I don't have the total vote here. I forgot to write that down. I'm sorry. I have to go look it up. And in at the end of January, again, when that... in the economic stimulus conference report that went to the president did not include funding for faith-based programs that Bush had started, and that there were some mixed messages about how Obama even felt about that, I think. But the House had included it in their bill, and the Senate had not. And when it went to conference, it was taken out. So, and they had encouraged people to contact their representatives and senators, particularly if they happen to be on the conference committee. As somebody who worked for the federal government for the last 20-some years, I can tell you that it was an eye-opener to me to find out when I my early misconceptions about the fact that when a bill is passed by the House and a bill is passed by the Senate and it goes to a conference committee to iron out the differences and come up with a compromise bill that then goes back and it gets usually passed by both houses and then goes to the president for signature. My understanding had always been that they basically were limited to what was in one bill or the other bill into what they could put into the ultimate bill. But it turns out that this is far from reality, that they pretty much put in anything they want. And so you wind up with this very small group of like 15 people that are the conference committee.
Weird thing in.
Some from the House, some from the Senate, always a majority from the majority party. And they pretty much write whatever the heck they
it's
want.
Like a, like a constitutional convention.
Yeah, it is. It's just
creating
mind-boggling.
A constitution.
And since I was involved in a lot of policy issues with my agency, which is the agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, we would be flabbergasted at, you know, we would know what went in, and we would know, you know, we're going to probably have to do this or this, and then suddenly something comes out that's completely different. It's like, where in the heck did that come from?
So that's a hot point to influence things.
Yeah.
Is at that conference committee stage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you keep aware of what they're doing.
Well, and it's behind closed doors.
Right. They're very closed doors. Nobody knows what goes on in there.
So that's really bad.
Yeah. So it's
like sending a 900-page bill that you wrote the night before and expect them to vote on it that day.
That's what I was asking about, the timing, and when those, is there any rule that...
How long it has to be exposed to the public.
They can vote on it the very next day.
Oh, yeah, they come out, they vote on them pretty quickly, usually, and I think most congressmen and senators would tell you that when it comes out, they probably don't read it. They just know, you know, more or less what, you know, their party is saying they should do, and they probably do it, or, you know, maybe they have a particular concern in a particular bill, you know, with one part of it, and so maybe they have one of their staff people find out what that part says. But I think in general they do not read those things.
Well, they don't have time.
Yeah.
Boy, that's scary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So that's up through... up through today, that's 1, 2, I didn't mention everyone, but 3, 4, 5. There were 5 this year. I think there were 9 last year.
So they don't overwhelm you with
stuff.
No,
they do not overwhelm you. So, I mean, it is a good thing because to sign up for that, because I think you can be in a position to help influence things in areas that concern you. And of course, there are other areas than this. You can get on other action alerts from other groups. But
The group called Americans United for Separation
of Church and State,
Barry Lynn.
Right.
Now, do they have kind of a coalition? I mean, this is a coalition of this particular 10. Member group.
Right.
But it seems like some of these issues are also those that that group
that other groups might be interested.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And as I said at the beginning, that, you know, there are other groups that are very concerned about separation of church and state issues, like Americans United. They are primarily an organization of individuals, the Americans United individuals can join them and support them. And their fundamental requirement, or really their rule for if you want to join them, is, you know, do you believe in separation of church and state? So they welcome all comers, religious, non-religious, free thinkers, and so on. And they have them. I mean, many of the members of many of the organizations that are in the secular coalition probably individually are members of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And certainly the secular coalition and Americans United are on the same side of most every issue, I would say, that they're interested in. Because fundamentally, you know, we have the same focus.
I'd be curious to know how many of us are members of the Americans United. I am.
Separation of church and state?
I have been, but I don't think I've renewed in the last couple of years.
Isn't there a Baptist group? Maybe it's the Liberty Foundation that the Secular Coalition has partnered with on some of these issues?
Oh, I thought the separation of church and state had gone.
I mean, there are some religious groups that are strongly in favor of separation of church and state.
Thank goodness.
The Baptist
Christian minister.
Early in the colonial period, Roger Williams was the one who set up some of the founding principles of separation of church and state. And he was a Baptist because at the University of Chicago, the Roger Williams Foundation was part of the American Baptist Theological Union.
Okay.
Wow.
But
like
is that the group
Baptists
that we commonly now call the Northern Baptists as opposed to the Southern Baptists?
There are different. I mean,
a lot of flavors.
There are the American Baptists, which were the more liberal, the Northern.
Right.
They're also called Northern Baptists because they were against
slavery. They used to be
slavery.
Called, I think, the Northern
I mean,
Baptist,
they were the abolitionist group or the Southern group. I mean, it resolved around the holding of slaves.
Okay. The Baptist, there are some ways of the Baptists that are liberal enough that in the early 1900s, the Universalists and some of the Baptists actually talked about merger.
Yeah.
It didn't actually ever happen.
Oh, yeah.
But
When I wasn't at Virginia, where the Baptists, because of the threat of the Presbyterians becoming a state church, I mean, that was a serious concern. And I think it was Virginia, where the Baptists were very strong in opposing or in promoting separation of church and state.
Well, I believe the fundamentalists are cocky enough about their efforts to take over the government that they do not believe that the government will do anything but take over, make it more fundamentalist. So I see there's a very concerted. No, there was a change a few years ago, and the fundamentalists went from being separated from governmental action. They ignored it basically, and they said we'll leave our own lives and our churches, to consciously working to take over the governmental policies.
Right. Well, there were, I think, you know,
I used to be able to name all the players in
It was in the early 70s that people got
Jerry
together
was
and
the,
laid
the,
that
the,
blueprint.
The moral majority person.
Mm-hmm.
But then Richard Viguerie was involved. It was wealth, it was politics, and it was religion that all kind of coalesced.
They accused the humanists of trying to dominate the religion of the government.
The religion of what?
Of the government.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, the university in Washington, in Maryland nearby or something, Virginia, which trains in their graduate school what's the name of it?
Regent.
Regent University. Mm-hmm. Trains their graduate students specifically to go into government in high places. And, of course, under both the Bushes and Reagan earlier, a lot of them did get appointed to very influential positions in the U.S. government.
So they have a law school, Regent Law School.
Law school.
Yeah, they're graduates.
So a lot of them got both legal degrees and degrees in government.
Poli-sci.
I have to leave because I got
I think a lot of people in Bush's Justice Department came from that school.
Right.
They had no experience, but they were shoved into the Justice Department.
They had the right attitude.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's about 5-2, so
I think I'd be very understanding.
Wrapping up, but anybody?
If my representative came and didn't vote for this, in God we trust, because he could simply say, you know, if I do that, they're going to crucify me, and you're going to end up with the other guy. And I think of Steve Kagan, who twice beat this, who was the guy from Peshtigo that used to be the Speaker of the House in Wisconsin?
How soon we forget.
And he would beat him the next time, I'm sure, if he did that. And so I'd accept that. I'd say, okay, I can understand you want to fight this fight because it's going to kill you, and I'd rather have you stick around for health care and everything more important.
Yeah, but when healthcare. Does compromise end up being...
Well, that's the question. I
it's
not here.
Such an interesting question.
You'd rather not...
Sure, but I know what I'm saying in my situation, right. That would be a compromise that I would be more than willing to make. No, I can understand when people wouldn't, but I don't expect people to dash themselves onto the rocks. And they could swim around.
Oh, sure, just like Feingold when he voted against the Patriot Act. Everybody told him he would.
Yeah,
he
sure.
He was killing his career.
And I can understand that.
And he did, of course, did it anyway.
Yeah.
And it ended up making his career.
Yeah.
But but he didn't know that at the time.
Maybe
I mean, he just said, I can't. I read this thing. Mm-hmm. I stayed up all night reading.
Yeah, he'd have to stay up all night.
Well, I admire a person
it.
That does that.
Well, yeah, most everybody had that.
You know, it was one of those things that we were talking about before.
Well, that's the one.
People got a couple of hours.
Right, I think he was the only one who actually read the thing.
But that's really scary to think about. That they're making laws, and it's so hard to get rid of those laws. You know, they make a law, and they haven't even read the whole thing, and they vote for it, and like, you know, all the ramifications of like the Patriot Act. I mean, it's like
there
really
was so much pressure
horrible.
After 9/11.
Right,
there was so much pressure.
Right,
but get these things through.
Yeah.
My worry about how mainstream the fundamentalist push for religiousizing government has gone. Is that we have a member of the United Church of Christ who seems to think that it's necessary to end every speech in God Bless America as a president. And talk about a non-right-wing church. It would seem to me, you know, that's part of the whole process, is that we now expect as the compromise that if a president doesn't end a speech in God Bless America.
Right, he's
not American.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like all the thing about the little flag pin.
Yeah,
right.
So this is really pervasive in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's important to have groups like the Secular Coalition who are trying to say, wait a minute, we don't need to do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't hurt religious beliefs. If we keep our
we
government from being partisan in relation to any particular religious tradition, and I think that is really important. And so, Ron, thank you for being involved, and thanks for sharing some of the thoughts of your work.
Yes, thank you very much, Ron. Let's give him a hand.
Thanks for coming.